So I told the guy, and then I punched him right in the face. That was the whole
And
story.
he deserved it.
He did. He did.
He totally
But you
did.
should not have used the taser where you used the taser.
He was screaming, "Don't tase me, bro," just like the YouTube video, but I just kept doing
Oh,
it. You know what? Like,
that is an old.
Did he have a mustache?
He did not, and that's why he got the taser. So it's
I'm scared without. Okay, can we speculate on what Ryan's doing right now? What do you think he's doing?
We probably shouldn't, but it's go time, isn't it?
I hope he's adopting another cat. And we can
Another
pre-show
cat.
for a bit. I guess if you want to, Kelly wants to roll. Let's roll.
We're on.
Kelly
We're
said start her up, so go.
Well, she wants to roll the finger.
You
want
to,
Kelly
you want
wants
to start
to roll
it?
the
All
finger.
right, here we
Start
go.
it up.
Let's do it.
Hello and welcome to Black Hills Information Security's Taco and About News. It's March 4th, 2024. This week, we've got malicious GitHub repos. We've got dubious claims of personal massagers being infected with malware. We've got ransomware, as always. We've got executive orders. And we've got an illustrious cast of characters. We've got mustache, no mustache, no mustache, kind of mustache, no mustache. Everyone's
menopause
either mustache. Wait, is your mustache considered a menopause mustache? I hope not.
I guess it is now by Kelly. Gosh, thanks
you
a lot.
You should see your doctor about that. So, okay, what are we talking about first? Who, executive order? I mean, I was reading this. Essentially, there's an executive order. The headline officially is Executive Order on Preventing Access to Americans' Bulk Sensitive Personal Data and United States Government-Related Data by countries of concern. That's really a mouthful.
What's the acronym for that?
Does anyone have any? What's the acronym? Yeah, no, I can't do it. Yeah, they should have come up with a cool acronym. They didn't. That was a big missed opportunity. But essentially, this is saying you can't sell our data to Saudi Arabia because we want to sell our data to Saudi Arabia, right? Is that the correct hot take?
Maybe we could clarify that a little, Corey. I think, well, first of all, let's talk about what the intention was. There is so much data about us. You know, that whole adage of if it's free, it's not really free. They're just selling your data. I think it's become more and more of a risk as we look at how much data is being collected on us. President Biden stepped in and said that he wants to limit outbound data transfers of data of U.S. citizens. And I'm kind of for it, quite frankly.
So, and I don't know if you know, I don't want to put you too much on the spot here, Kelly, but does my like preferences for cat memes, is that considered sensitive data? Or is it like, what are they counting in here of sensitive data?
Depends on
There's
the color
six.
Of the cat.
Oh, and the mustache. There's actually six categories of sensitive data. Number one, bioidentifiers. I don't know. Is there anybody on that panel who is okay with their bioidentifiers being sold?
They no. definitely have been.
What is that? Is that like a finger? Like, what is a bio? A face? My face?
DNA, probably.
That one?
It can be the color of your eyes. It could be if you've got a twitch. It could even include something like how you walk. You know, if you're a saunterer or if you walk with really short steps and kind of uptight. So
is there like
identifiers.
I'm sorry, but is there like, these things are so specific. I am so scared right now.
What is this about? What's the short step?
We're figuring out if
you're listing
if other
things
countries
that,
can download the data to clone us.
Yeah. Well, Kelly's listing examples of sensitive data, and she's listing things that are super terrifying and super real, and I was not prepared for how real they were.
Are we
way you walk, like gait analysis, right? That's what she's talking about. Is it is actually, if someone's wearing a face mask and everything, you can potentially identify who they are based on how they walk. So I guess I fully support the concept, but I'm also kind of curious, what is a country of concern? Because we're the country of most concern from my perspective, but is this related to the Gaza Palestine thing? Is it like people are worried about people that are pro or anti one side or the other being targeted with hacking? Like, how does this tie, or is it just completely not related to anything else?
Well, Corey, I think, I don't know if it's directly related to Gaza, but do you remember me talking about the origins of GDPR? And I said in Europe, GDPR's origins go all the way back to World War II and the terrible, terrible things that happened in Germany. And in our lingo today, they were using bioidentifiers to mass extinction of people of a certain ethnic and religious background. As the world is becoming more and more divisive, I believe we're trying to protect things that really do speak to who we are as people. If it is our gait, if it is our bio identifiers, if it's our religion, if we're private about it. So I don't know if there was an exact event that led to this executive order or if it was just thunder building in the horizon.
Huh. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's super fascinating. I guess who does this impact the most? What people, I mean, data brokers are the obvious, like where my mind goes, but who is benefiting from shipping off American sensitive data to countries of concern? Or so is it more a criminal thing? Is it not like a capitalism thing? It's more like a criminal thing.
So there's two problems with that. I mean, of course, the whole like countries of concern thing is a concern, but. This actually goes back to a class action lawsuit that was brought against Microsoft for, I think it was still Internet Explorer back in the day. And Microsoft is collecting a lot of telemetry off of browsers of users, and they were caught doing it, of course. And the class action lawsuit was basically, you're aggregating a whole bunch of our data, Microsoft, and you shouldn't do it. In that particular case, the judge dismissed it on a very interesting kind of premise. Under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, you have to exceed over $5,000 of damages in order to bring a case against somebody for breaking the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And the judge said that not a single one of the victims in the class action lawsuit could actually show that there was $5,000 of damages associated with that lawsuit. And I'm bringing up this particular case because it's similar, right? If we have this data that's getting leaked out, we have gait data, as an example, being released. It's not just an issue that the data is released. It's not that that data does or doesn't cause damage. The biggest problem is, did it cause damages in excess of over $5,000? So there's a bunch of these different things whenever we're talking about these data sets and all of these different things, whether it's countries of concern, whether it's a legal thing here, actually pinning down the total amount of damages can be very, very difficult in U.S. and international courts.
Makes sense. I guess we'll have to kind of track the fallout of this on the show. I mean, who knows?
I just died. I started quoting laws and everyone's like,
My first thought was, how can I cause damage that's under $5,000?
He just did a restream fart. Jesus.
I think basically this one is one where I think we're going to have to monitor and see the repercussions of this. It's hard when the, you know, executive orders or just executive directives are kind of a dollar or dime a dozen these days of like, you know, I just, all people should drink black coffee and like no one does it and no one cares. It's like, whatever. Yeah. But maybe it'll actually be impactful. We'll see. It seems like it has a lot of teeth baked into it, but you never know. It might get, it'll probably get struck down by a judge in, let's say, 36 hours.
there we go.
I'll give you another example. Do you remember Strava? It's like a run keeper. It's an exercising app that shows you geographically where you've been running.
Yeah, I remember stories on this.
Yeah, do you remember how they were pretty much mapping out bases based on people's Strava data?
Yeah, undisclosed bases. They would have a heat map of where is common to exercise. And if you looked in the desert in Afghanistan, you would find the bases because the heat map is people recording activities. And yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So anyway, who's got another article for us? Andrew, I know you wanted to talk about infected GitHub
repos.
Did
we talk about the 2FA codes?
Not yet.
No.
You want to talk about 2FA codes?
God, this is one of those articles that just keeps giving. Like when you start reading it, it's like through the looking, you expect to get smaller or larger somehow by you actually reading it. Leaky database spilled 2-factor codes for the world's tech giants. There's a technology company, YX International. They do cellular networking and they actually send the SMS text messages on behalf of various cell providers. So far, that doesn't sound terrifying at all. Arnag Shin, a good faith security researcher and expert in discovering sensitive but inadvertently exposed data sets leaked to the internet, found the database, which was wide open to the internet. The only thing that you needed to access of this database was a browser. And inside of this exposed database, it included contents of text messages sent to users, including one-time passcodes, password reset links for some of the world's largest tech companies, including Facebook, WhatsApp, Google, TikTok, and others. And it had logs going all the way back to 2023, and it was growing in size constantly. So it kept on going up. Now, whenever YX International was asked about this vulnerability, they basically were like, yeah, we quote unquote sealed the vulnerability, which is awesome, I guess.
They invented a whole new sentence.
They also said that they would not say how long the database was exposed.
Or whether anyone accessed it, because they don't store access logs.
So wait. No. This one we know the answer to. Because when TechCrunch asked YX International about this, they said their server did not store access logs, which could have determined if anyone other than Sen had discovered the exposed database and its contents.
That's the legal team is like super happy about that. Yeah, right, so now they're like,
somebody handed them a sticker of like the no logs, no breach. And they were like, that is, the legal team saw that and they go, yes.
We need someone to take No Woman, No Cry and change that no logs, no breach. Oh my God.
So, does anyone know any technical details? Was it just like a random MySQL database? Like,
I don't know. Was it an S3
bucket? Like, I'm just curious, like, how badly did they mess up? That's my question. Obviously, not having logs.
You can just access it with a browser. At that point, it's bad, right? Like,
I'm thinking
really,
PHP
really
my
bad
admin.
At that point.
I'm thinking PHP my admin with default creds. Who's with me?
Yeah, this whole episode of the show is all going to be like PHP is bad and WordPress is bad. Okay, you should stop using those things. So, who knows? What they were actually using from a technical perspective. By the way, Corey, your mic is a little weak sauce. Compared to others.
I'll just yell. It's fine.
That's what we do here anyway. So, Andrew, like, I once again, we're looking at this like it's going to come down to some unsecured like cloud service that every time the admin logged into it, there's bright red warnings. It's like, this is completely wide open. It's like, yeah, but whatever.
And we actually talk about this all the time, like the value of doing both types of logging in cloud provider environments, because if you're not logging data plane events and control plane events, you lose some resolution on what happened. Like in this case, it looks like it's just data plane. But of course, if you were to compromise the system, you can pivot from there into the account, or you can pivot laterally. And most of the logs that people turn on in cloud environments, believe it or not, they actually don't track data plane events by default. So that's a fun and interesting fact.
Great. I didn't know that. Thank you. That's
so no, a data a plane event. Sorry.
Is it just now for most providers, do you have to pay for that, or is it just you just turn it on?
So in most providers, the actual logging service is free. You just pay for the gigabytes of storage that
pay for it, but not enough to be a concern, really.
I mean, it really depends on what you're doing in the environment. Like, I've worked some really gnarly incidents where the audit logs were like 700 gigabytes per day, for example. And I've worked some where it's like 500 megabytes per day. It just depends on how active that cloud environment actually is.
Wow. That's crazy pills.
It is.
All right. Cool. All right. Anyone else have anything else on this? Because there are so many like horrible, stupid hacks that are coming here.
Okay. I have one more question. Should this be stored in a database at all? I mean, why would you have a database of like, I mean, I guess you technically need a database to be like, this password reset link is valid for this amount of time. Like, but, I guess. But why would you store the actual code? I guess I don't. Shouldn't it be hashed? Shouldn't the code be hashed?
But it's in a database, early bird, Corey. But it's in a database. That's what you do. You put data in a database. Why are you questioning this? Like,
is that why my passwords are all in clear text? Is that
this
why?
Seems completely legit. And the password reset links? Yeah, of course we're going to store those because
they're not sensitive. Nothing stored in a URL is sensitive. We know this.
Never, ever. Yeah. Now, I want you to think of this. Would you rather be in a situation where you don't have it and you need it, or would you have a situation where your server is exposed to the internet and everyone can gain access to it with a browser? I want you to think long and hard about that, Corey.
All right. I thought about it, and what I thought was no logs, no breach. I'm good.
Good go. Awesome. I'm glad we're all clear on that, too. Somebody was going to say something else. Go for it.
Yeah, I was just going to say...
Go ahead, Kelly.
Go ahead, Andrew.
I don't know.
Oh, I was just
Kelly, okay. Go ahead and go.
I really appreciated Ben from Casey's comment about logs. You got country and Western, and I think that's really important to remember.
I think that makes about as much sense the conversation that Corey and I just had. So Ben just summed that up. Andrew, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, even if you are storing these things in a database, right, like there's lots of great facilities for protecting these things in databases. And again, like there's really no excuse to at least like context aware encrypt that column that's full of sensitive data, or like break it out to another table that somehow is protected or is like auto expiring or has time to live on those values. So there's just like a lot of missteps.
So Andrew, it's almost like you're saying you can store this stuff that you don't need to store that actually opens up wide security vulnerabilities. And seriously, you don't need it after a couple of minutes and you can do it securely in the future. Yeah,
if you want to follow these anti-patterns, there's ways to do it right. And people, I mean, I've seen tons of architecture diagrams where people do things like this, right? Because you have to be able to verify the token on both sides. And yes, you could do it with a hash, but like, let's say it's a first iteration or something and you're just not going to come back to it. You know, it's totally valid and people do it all the time, but like put the right controls on it.
Okay. Last hot take or question about this. Big tech companies are apparently using this. I mean, it comes up on the show almost every week, but the whole supply chain management, third party risk management thing. We know that, you know, the CISOs, their biggest concern or one of their biggest concerns this year is supply chain risk management or third party risk management, whatever you want to call it. Is there anything like, how do you pick an SMS provider that doesn't suck? Is there a way to do it? How should I, if I'm a CISO and I was using XY International, how did I get in this boat? Why am I using XY International and what can I do differently?
Just YOLO. I don't know what you would have done differently in this. Like some type. So one of the things I think you might ask for is a letter of attestation. Like when's the last time they were tested? And was it tested by a reputable firm? And good luck like defining what a reputable firm is. By the way, if you do need a reputable firm, we'd like to humbly.
We'll find your exposed databases.
All right. So, but moving on. But no, I think that that's a good question. You know, I almost wonder sometimes if like externals, like the pen test reports for companies, like let's just kill the security scorecard type companies and just make it so like all external pen tests are like public record, like cryptocurrency implementation, smart contracts are publicly posted. The audits of them many times are. That's just one of the things I think would be really, really, really cool because like seriously, from a supply chain perspective, we got Jack, unless somebody has something magical that they can throw it and say, yes, yeah, this is in fact a trustworthy company that gets them a good seal of approval.
Like, yeah, if you search this company, the only thing that comes up is breach. Like, like they don't, okay, they don't okay. They're not.
That would be a good first check, right? Like do a search for breach.
Like, is this like, how do they even find, like, they have 50 to one, according to LinkedIn, they have 51 to 200 employees. Like, how did these providers, like, how was Twitter and Google like, oh yeah, we should use them. That makes sense.
A lot of them are just people who know people. Twilio, that's honestly, why. A lot of them are just people who know people.
Yeah.
And
hey, I'd like to weigh in on this.
Go for it, Kelly.
I know you guys are very technical in nature, and that's super cool. One thing I didn't get a chance to talk about last week was NIST released the updated version of the cybersecurity framework version 2.0. And there was two big things that they updated. A, they added another function. So remember you had identify, protect, respond, detect, you know, the other functions. They've added a governance function. Different conversation, different time, but they specifically focused on cyber supply chain risk management. And one of the things they did is they said, listen, yes, absolutely, this is hard to manage. They've come up with a guide. I can't remember exactly what they call it, a rapid deployment guide or a implementation guide, but it takes the issue of supply chain management, no matter the size of your organization, and steps you back from it and starts with what we've seen over and over again, John, is inventory. If you can't even tell me who is in your supply chain, let's start there, just like we start with inventory with the CIS controls. So I think there are solutions. And Corey, to your question, maybe most people at that organization didn't even know that they were using that company for SMS
probably
tooling.
That's probably 100% true. That's a really good point. The first step is figure out who you're using. The second step is ask for a letter of attestation. So those two steps should take about 5 years. So get back to us. Let us know how it goes.
If you're at the CTO of Google, you're like, I just got a text message from us. Who are we using for that?
Then it's like backwards. Jeff Bezos bringing in Amazon boxes into like meetings and being like, this was delivered to the wrong address. And they're like, we didn't think you would get this deep.
All right. Yeah. Well, I got the next story I want to talk about. It's from Dark Reading. I got to be honest. There's a couple of stories here that are just fantastic this week. Hats off to Ryan. But this one, eBay, VMware, McAfee sites hijacked in sprawling phishing operation. Trusted brands like The Economist are also among the 8,000 entries compromised by Operation Pseudo-Mailing, which is the heart of a larger operation of a single threat actor. By the way, right off the
bat. I thought it was subdo-mailing.
No. Oh, subdo. Yeah, subdo. Subdo-mailing. So, yes.
This is better.
It would be better if it was pseudo-mailing. Maybe someday we'll get it. So, this is interesting because they use an example of like Martha Stewart. If you send an email from like Martha Stewart's domain, it's able to make it through and it's just fine. Like Martha Stewart goes through, you've approved Martha Stewart. That's fantastic. But if we go back 22 years ago with a domain that was abandoned, it was like Martha Stewart sweepstakes or something like that. Where is it? MSN Martha Stewart sweeps.com. is a subdomain promotional sweeps campaign 22 years ago. Though the domain was abandoned for 21 years, it was privately re-registered again through Namecheap in 2022. Now, what happens is the SPF records, I think I'm getting this right, or SPM records. Whenever you set up a domain like Martha Stewart sweeps and you have Martha Stewart, it basically trusts not just the main domain, but all of the other subdomains that are out there as well. So they're going through, they're sweeping up a whole bunch of these different subdomains for these different companies that have become abandoned over the years. SPF, thank you so much. And they're sending the emails from the domains that are timed out, dead and gone, because at some point in the past they were associated, it's allowed to go right through and make it into the inbox.
So this is a stale... Okay, this is a combination of two things, right?
Uh-huh.
Number one, a bad SPF config
that
had a stale address in it, that 64 address. And two, a stale DNS domain that had the address that pointed to it, right?
Yep.
So it's like tech debt turned into a horrible
exploit. Yeah, but think about this. By the way, Loki, if you could do us a favor, you did a blog about this last week. If you could share that blog post with everybody, that would be amazing. I recommend sharing it out on the Discords and the YouTubes because it'll be stared there forever. But Ben of KC says, unfortunately, Microsoft insists this is not a problem.
Yes, and this is a feature.
Yeah.
And well, phishing is intended.
I think also for SPF records, I'm trying to find the setting, but hopefully somebody in the chat will know that like there is some sort of setting that can go into for Microsoft to just like override and deliver the mail anyways.
Yep.
It's
soft fail. So you can soft fail or hard fail on SPF.
Yeah, I thought there was like some other setting to where it's like Microsoft was like, we need this, like otherwise like so much email is just not going to get delivered if you go SPF fail. It's like, no, if you're like 0365.
Well, most
like,
providers, most people don't even use SPF at all. What they do is they set it to wide open. They let their email filter handle the rest, which is like arguably not a great idea. But
look, yeah. I'm going to just admit this, like years and years and years ago, looked at the way emails were being sent, all of these different things, sender policy frameworks and DKIM and all this stuff. And I looked at that and I'm like, I'm not putting my hand in that box because I'm going to get pricked by a Gom Jabbar. Sorry, I saw Dune 2. By the way, if you haven't seen Dune 2, you should. It is fantastic. But at any rate, that's a squirrel.
The knife fights.
Where's the ouchie? Like, where is the config somewhere that you have to go and clean up? Like, where is it stale? Or is it because it was associated 22 years ago that all of these email servers just remember these two things were associated with each other? Like, where is that config so that people can go and, like, where is it? Where is the config? Or we can fix it. Where would we do
it? It's in the parent. It's in the parent DNS domain in this case, I believe. So like if it is like xyz.marthastewart.com, it'd be in marthastewart.com for the subdomain. So wherever that is hosted. So bonus points to the attacker, right? If this domain was registered on Namecheap before and they re-registered it because they wanted to use the IPs from the same mail relay by capitalizing on just knowing who it was registered with, because those IPs probably haven't changed in 20 years.
Yeah,
it's really it's a really cool attack, but it's just phishing, so it's like not that cool. But it is like all the stuff, like it's such a cool attack, but then it results in just like people clicking emails, which is like
See, but this is one of those things, like whenever you're around a bunch of people and you're talking email security, like Hackchar says, one thing to remember, if you use DKIM, it'll sign your message to the public key that's in DNS. If your emails get stolen and leaked, they can be verified as real. And then somebody's going to talk about SPF. And then somebody said they're skeptical of Dune. So I understand that.
But I would disagree with Corey. It
seriously feels like to me, it's like when you get a bunch of Linux people together and they start talking about distros. Like if somebody has no idea what Linux is, they just sit in the room. They're like, I hope to God no one asks me any questions on this. So,
yeah. And then you try to fix it and you try to fix it. And then, you know, marketing emails aren't being sent out by your company.
Exactly.
Or like you have like they use like some like obscure like subdomain. And it's like, well, we tried to fix this. Like, according to all of our metrics, like these are the only places emails should be coming from. And it's like, oh no, now we can't do like.
And every time a new guy, Alex, every time a new guy comes in, they're like, "Yeah, have you seen our mail setup? It's a nightmare." Like, don't look at it.
Don't look at it.
Don't touch it.
Yeah.
Don't touch it.
Yeah, and I will say also, like, to be perfectly honest, there's two cards I want to play here. Number one is email filtering is in the realm of AI now. There's no one out there that's like. Like even people that work at Proofpoint or Mimecast or wherever aren't able to say, here's exactly what email will make it past. And here's what exactly email won't make it past. It's all heuristics and AI and complex machine learning. Like, so what that means is in general, filtering has across the board gotten better, but it also means if you are one of these attackers and you have time to sit down and poke and prod, eventually you're going to find either a logical gap like this, or just a simple gap, like there's been much research over the years of like, if you include certain names or random things, it'll say, oh, this gives you a positive spam score because it has the name, you know, whereas if you put like, please scan this QR code, it's going straight to spam. So
yeah,
at the end of the day, we all have to just operate on the assumption that someone can bypass your email filter. Just assume it can happen. Yes. And step with, yeah, like just it's, and this is a cool way to say
in
this,
most, in like most phishing email stuff, right? Every executive always asks, well, how did the email get in? That's always the first one.
And you're like, true. There's a black box of magic that allowed it through. Yeah.
Well, and SPF most, passing. Most
red team tests, that's the first thing I've always looked at. Okay, how did they bypass all of our filters? Just because that's going to be, it should be one of the easier things to block. At least that makes sure you have everything set up correctly, but it's not. And an attack like this, I think, is actually like pretty cool. Even it's though, like Corey cool, said, it's not crazy. But as a blue teamer, I'm like, I would have no clue. I would be stumped and have to move to the next.
But Wade, form like of attack. Loki has been mentioning this too, but I think we can all agree, hats off. Well done, hackers. Yeah. Like, this is a cool attack, right? Like, once again, it comes back to like, oh, they exploited a vulnerability in WordPress or PHP. It's like, okay, well, that's just a day ending. And why? DOS attacks, you know, they're using a botnet to bring down an organization. Okay, whatever. There's so many stories that we talk about where there's not a new novel technique involved in it. And this is awesome. Like for me, you know, in the offensive space, it's just like,
is there okay, any but dates associated with those DNS records that where you could like, how would you figure it out? Like, can you go?
Oh, you would just—it's like Cloud Raccoon or whatever that tool from back in the day. You just find stale DNS records, then you figure out if you can register them or not. Like,
wait,
it's like
Space Jam? Is that website still up?
So, I don't know. So, as a security vendor, should I right now go look and start blacklisting all of the old domains that are like 10 plus years or add a switch? Be like, this domain was registered or hasn't
changed. Yeah, you should do that. If you do that, you'll never get any phishes because all the big tech companies will not be able to send emails anymore.
It's perfect.
No, I mean, there's no way around this. Honestly, okay, one final hot take is, who the hell is clicking things from msnmarthastewart.com?
But I think that was the example. I agree with that. I think like, that was like, the example.
Oh, shit,
this type of vulnerability was in a number of companies that had these old subdomains that they just expired out.
Yes. And it's super common. I mean, we've seen it with supply chain, like NPM. You know, we talked about it a couple years ago on the show, like 40% of NPM packages are like maintainers include expired domains that you could just go register. You know what I mean? Like,
oh God,
there's fun supply chain things all over the place of like people not registering. I mean, if you, and we encounter this with our continuous penetration testing customers, they'll have stale buckets and things. Like they'll be like a website that has a JavaScript that points to an Azure websites or Azure bucket or an S3 bucket that like no one owns anymore. So you could just go like register the bucket and put that JavaScript file with malicious JavaScript. And like, now you have a keylogger on any site that uses that. This is a common thing. Stale DNS. I mean, DNS is a huge beast to manage and yeah, it's tough.
I think also with some of these companies that I looked over the names and you know, one that stuck out to me was Marvel, and you just have all these probably mergers and acquisitions and Marvel mm-hmm. being like, okay, we're going to buy this property and not realizing that there's like some subdomain from like a whole comic series 22 years ago that is still set up. And
yeah, you're going to get a phishing message from Spider-Man.
Alex saw that one, like he's running around his house, like, unplug everything, unplug everything.
Do not click the email from Thor. Do not click the email from Thor or Spider-Man. They're both spam.
The Stark Industries.org promotional website or something there that was spun up for like the movie that they were going to have Tom Cruise do like back in 1998. And yeah.
We try not to talk about that, but thanks, Alex, for bringing up a dark history.
The dark history
in the world of comics.
Well, I'm still going to get my Pepsi points and get a jet anyway. Okay, who wants to talk about United Health? I mean, I don't know how much you talked about it last week, but basically
Avanti one is queued up.
Okay, Avanti.
So we'll get to United Health. Avanti.
I mean,
isn't
Avanti just the same article over and over again at this point?
Like, yeah, but it's one of those articles that's a gift that just keeps on giving. Mandiant came out with some research where they estimate that thousands of these devices have been exploited and they've been patched. A bunch of people scrambled to patch their devices, right? There was like, what was there? Five different vulnerabilities that were showing up. And like two of them were remote execution. They were bad. They were bad vulnerabilities, what we're trying to say, and they just keep showing up. But the patches hit, and Mandiant believes that there has been thousands of these devices that were compromised, and they're still compromised. So basically, it's the equivalent of a whole bunch of like hackers get into the device, you patch it, the hackers are still on the patch device.
Well, yeah, it turns out patching is not incident response.
Yes, thank you.
I applied the patch, but the back door is still in the system. Yep,
I just keep thinking that the CTO or CISO of Avanti is like, oh, sir, we've got a call. Oh God, who is it this time? It's Mandiant. Just tell him to go away. They said it's important. I don't want to talk to Mandiant. It's your job. You've got to talk to Mandiant. And it's like, what now? Well, it turns out a bunch of your devices are actually still exploited. Crap. I should have taken that job as a sales rep at Cisco instead.
Is there any hard details on whether these are devices that were exploited prior or are the patches ineffective? I'm assuming it's exploited prior.
No. They were
patching.
Prior. So they think most of them are hacked from China. So literally they got in before the patch came or before the device was patched by the owner.
Yeah, before the disclosure and
Yeah. And then they just stayed.
So, okay, we talked about it on the show, but like this is that CISA emergency directive, the first one they ever did. So my question is,
I think that's part of it. They're just like, unplug the freaking things because it was
the directive said patch or unplug. Right.
Yeah.
But the directive should have said patch and unplug and also do incident response and then turn it back on. Avanti, to their credit, have released like integrity checking solutions. Like, turns out when you update the firmware or a patch, you should like make sure the patches are good. Basically, you had to be pretty short-sighted to still be vulnerable to this. You're warned. You're told by an emergency directive, either unplug it or patch. But I will say the emergency directive probably should have, I don't know if it did or not, but it should have accounted for, while you're patching, maybe check for backdoors and do some IR on your device at the same time, right?
This sounds really bad, but as like a blue team,
Shadow Ninja 85 said, wasn't there an IR game somewhere that includes persistence as one of the key things to figure out? What is this magical game you speak
Dungeons
of?
And Dungeons and
Dungeons
breaches?
Dungeons and like cubicles and compromises? No. It's backdoors and breaches. You can go to play.backdoorsandbreaches.com and you can play the game. And yes, when we set up the game, literally persistence is one of those things you have to figure out as part of IR.
And for those working at Avanti, warning, the game may cause PTSD. So
probably. Too real, man. Too real.
The game might feel too real to you. Yeah.
To go back to your question, in CISA's advisory, they said this, I'm quoting here, the safest course of action for network defenders is to assume a sophisticated threat actor may deploy root kick level persistence on the device that has been reset and laid dormant for an arbitrary amount of time.
So they definitely warned people appropriately, and people were like, I patched. Apt-get update, apt-get upgrade, reboot. All right, we're good. Thanks, everyone. See you tomorrow. Yeah, I don't know. Not
or,
great.
You know, another perspective is the business said, hey, we can't be down. Plug those things back in. You said all you have to do is patch. And it seems like there's a conversation about risk management internally in the company. Maybe they were forced to turn it back on. Maybe they didn't allot enough time for incident response. I think it's a cultural issue.
Maybe they had no logs and they're like, no logs, no incident.
Is my volume good? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I just found out like my volume was down to 10% on the system level. And that's why nobody here has heard
now
me for the last like 6 weeks.
Now it's back over 9,000, Wade.
Perfect. That's where I belong.
take it back just a hair.
Just a hair.
You are clipping.
Okay.
I can hear the AC voltage linking through your house. Anyway.
You can hear, dude, I got a new graphics card.
I can hear your heartbeat. You're running a little fast. Anyway.
My question, like, this is to more Alex and Mike. Like, I will admit, as a blue teamer, I don't think, like, after a big patch has occurred, I don't think I've ever done, like, let's just focus on this box after the patch and make sure that it wasn't compromised. Like, we have other stuff going on, right? We have detections for it. And I've probably ran detections to see if it got compromised at one point, but I've never, like, checked to make sure that that persistence wasn't already there, at least. Which I sound really stupid about. Like, I feel really stupid.
I feel like you would if SZA said it's probably backdoor.
That's definitely true. If it was SZA, right? But even then, like, I think we know my relationship with SZA reports is like 90% of the time they're just like, it's vulnerable. And I'm like, all right, cool. Senior management, this is vulnerable. You guys need to make sure you patch that. That's the majority of my SZA reporting. But
wow.
I don't know. Mike or Alex, you guys got any hot takes on that?
I mean, I like the breach and attack sims that you have. Those modules oftentimes can get very updated for these things. So then you do that validation of, okay, just run the latest attack techniques against your Avantis if you have them in your environment and go, okay, well, we patched this, the attack updated. You know,
but that wouldn't help either because it already had a rootkit.
Guys, what we need to do is we need to create an AV company for Avanti devices now.
Well, hold on. I got a better idea, John. How about we just do like we call ourselves the Avanti Liquidators and we just walk into data centers with sledgehammers and just fix
Avanti
the problem.
Avanti Liquidators.
That's a good
and
hair
we
band.
Wear we all have mustaches and we have like those fire axes, you know, like has SZA issued an emergency directive to you? We'll come liquidate your Avanti devices at no charge.
You're right. Bro. Mine just made money. I think that your idea brings wellness and like a sense of purpose.
Also, you can sign up. It's like a volunteer thing, you know?
Nah, like I dig it. I like your idea better. Let's do that.
To answer Wade's question for me, usually what happens in my instances is that I'll see that there's something that's breachable that we've got. I'll do a hunt to see how much we've got available. And then it comes, have we been breached yet? It's hard to say that afterwards I make sure that nobody's still on there, but definitely beforehand and before they're patching, if I see somebody's been on there that we have been breached at that point, then yes, after we've done, I do the due diligence. But just to think of it afterwards, I don't think, and I haven't been asked that by
right?
much as far as upper management goes.
Right? I'm second guessing my entire career right now.
Sure, but if SZA says it has a rootkit,
kind of flippant for us just to say like, "Well, what do you mean you didn't do IR after you installed the patch?" Like, it would break IT if we did full IR after every
fair, patch. But every patch notification does not say by SZA this probably is already rooted with a rootkit. Like that's like I don't know. I mean,
the last time I did it was SolarWinds, but you know,
yeah, this is the next time you're going to do it. But yeah, anyway, we should move on. Let's talk about leaky GitHub or infected GitHub, because that was one that Andrew came to talk about and then he had to go. But we should still talk about it.
We lost Andrew in his honor. Crap. I didn't know. I'm sorry.
So this is
he's not dead.
I still have his hot. Yeah, he's still alive. For
oh,
those
he's
wondering.
Not. Oh, screw it then. Carry on.
Okay. No one has died during the show that we know of. Moving on. Infected repos on GitHub. This is something that Andrew basically, his hot take, which I can parrot, was that they've been reporting, his company has been reporting on this for years. We've talked about it on the show many times, but essentially this is research from a company called Apeiro, which sounds like a supervillain. And he goes, Apeiro! And then he like finds all your vulnerabilities and then he goes, Disapeiro! But anyway, these are like, I guess, watering hole attacks is how I would describe them. Essentially, some threat actor clones popular repos like Twitter follow bot, Discord boost tool, Twitch follow bot, and hundreds more. And then they inject malware into the repos and hope that people just clone the wrong repo. So yeah, that's basically the entire attack. I guess, does anyone have any hot takes on this? It seems, I guess it's one of those things that's like, I guess GitHub could scan for quote unquote malware, but
don't they already?
It's like the whole, it's the App Store thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
do they?
They
because
did.
Like,
they do already.
Yeah. Like, super common attack that I've seen is Red Teamer hosts malware. Like, they upload the malware to GitHub, pull it down real quick, and then immediately delete it because GitHub usually finds it and deletes it. And you
I mean, Metasploit's
but,
on there.
Yeah, but Metasploit's like trusted source, right? It's
yeah, but
not
that's
like.
Different. That's not malware.
It's totally
right?
Different.
If GitHub account is 10 days old and has malware, alert.
And not Metasploit.
It's not malware.
And
it's
not Metasploit.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know, but like. I guess it's the whole App Store thing. We've talked about it for years. Everyone knows every App Store is potentially vulnerable to malware. There's just no way if you have the volume and you have the, like, you can't thoroughly scan and manually check every GitHub repo. The volume is too big. Same's true with App Stores. Like
Apeiro can.
Apeiro! You have malware? Disapeiro! Okay. All right. Moving on. My only hot take on this is be careful what you clone. I think like
do not trust sources. Isn't that what it always is? Do you trust the source? Isn't that what it asks after you clone it? And you go, and everyone always just says yes.
Well, that's before or after you deployed that directly to production.
Usually before. So then my host and production are compromised. So
you mean you don't clone directly onto a production web app and then just install it from there?
That sounds a lot easier. I don't know why I haven't been doing that. You're absolutely right.
That's way safer. Yeah, I guess, you know, does GitHub have a role here to like put a little verified blue check mark on things? Like,
ooh,
this is malware free.
Don't tell them. There's going to be verified repos pretty soon for
$10. So back to the previous article we were talking about. Is it really GitHub's responsibility to check everything? Kind of like, yeah, we applied the patch, but they were still the deeply embedded in the system. Can't GitHub say the exact same thing that we said for the previous article? Just to play
totally
devil's advocate here?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Like they essentially, I guess what I would say is like every tech company is in the same boat, which is like, they're kind of a public utility that has no moderation and they're kind of not. And this is like actually right now the subject of a big Supreme Court thing. I don't know if anyone's following, but basically, truly from a business and general perspective, it's not like I can go sue GitHub for having malware on it, right? And I can't sue the Android App Store for having malware on it. And I can't sue Apple for having malware in their App Store. Like, but at the same time, there's some, they are clearly focused on trying to take down some malware and trying to like make it from a business perspective, they should prevent cloned repos with malware in it because that's super like not good for their business and general image. But like,
Kelly,
how do they do it? I don't know.
I don't know. I've got another take on it. And my take is they've got to at least try, even if they suck at it. Because if you look at like Twitter, you look at Facebook, you're looking at all these different things all the way back to MySpace, you're not really using that service for what it is. You're actually getting content moderation, or that's one of the biggest selling points of it, right? At least it was a long time ago in Twitter. But at any rate, so you have these places that you kind of have a forum or a commons, right? And there is some responsibility, right? I mean, you can't say it's infinitely elastic and say, well, GitHub doesn't worry about anything because then all of a sudden people could start putting child porn on GitHub, and that would be bad. And it's, you could argue, and I believe that it's a valid argument, that that's not really GitHub's responsibility, but still having a legal pornography on your service would be bad for business, and eventually people just aren't going to use it. So whenever you're looking at it from a legal liability perspective, I don't think that GitHub has a huge legal liability, but they do have a reputational liability in if all of a sudden GitHub is being used constantly to host malware. Malware like GCat or Metasploit or Sliver. God, I can't even speak. Jeez. you have all of these different things, but that's very, very different than all of a sudden people that are now slipping malware into different repositories, especially if it's being used again and again and again, various C++ libraries or Python projects or things of that nature. So if you're looking at GitHub, I would argue that they have some level of responsibility to do some level of checking, but there's ultimately going to be limits whenever you start getting to the diminishing returns of how much effort you're putting into it.
Yeah, and I agree, because I was thinking of it in kind of like a non-tech form of, you go to the grocery store, you get some stuff, you want to make sure there's not like poison in it. Now, is the grocery store checking every product that they have to make sure that it is not, you know, poisonous or anything? No, but they have some responsibility to make sure that, hey, they're not just a store that's selling bad product.
I like the taste of E. coli, though.
You know, hey, you have to check everything you come. E. coli. You have to check
Thanks,
everything.
Thanks, Alex. Now I have a new nightmare. I didn't even think of that.
There was that Twitter, the TikTok trend where people would go in and then like open an ice cream, lick it, and put it back. Right?
What? Okay. Yeah. Hold on. Yeah. It's so much worse than this, because in this world. As an example, has anyone gotten an email from their grocery store that isn't Costco about a recall?
No.
Okay, good. Neither have I.
They post them. You have to find them yourself.
Who is going and checking all the products that they've ever purchased manually to see if they have solvent?
I think I want my grocery store to have my email address. I disagree,
Corey, but there's been many times I've walked into a grocery store and they have had signs up that say that they've recalled a specific type of lettuce or spinach or something like that. Yep. That has
But that's, I already have the E. coli and I already ate it all, which is why I'm back at the grocery store, because I already ate all the food.
Yeah, and my grocery store doesn't have my email address. At least I hope they don't.
I will make a burner email that's ecoli@fakedomain.com. And if I get an email there, then something I'm eating is currently tainted and I should go vomit. Anyway.
My grocery store has your email.
Okay. Great. Yes. Great. And by the way, John, they're selling it. And now that the president has said they're not allowed to do that anymore, they're really mad.
You mean the security is getting in the way of our security? No.
And to wrap this up, though, I do want to say, as we know from the show, there have been no breaches involving developer stuff at all. And we know that developers are super supportive of putting security as their top priority, and this should have no future repercussions whatsoever.
You're right. This is a hypothetical that hasn't happened and never will happen.
No, it did not happen to Microsoft like a month ago or anything. Definitely not. No,
we've never. And for those of you that may be viewing this podcast internationally, and English is your second or third or maybe fourth language, we just demonstrated something called sarcasm. Just beware. Use my ex-girlfriend's parents' phone number. I'm not kidding. That's a little creepy.
If it works, it works. Also, 000000 always works.
Does it really? I'm going to have to try that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's, you know, the developers left some codes in there for us.
So talk about developers. Jackass has that number. Why do I keep getting calls from Home Depot?
Yeah, that's your number. Yeah. 867-5309 also usually works.
867-5309. Oh, my God.
Your area code
has that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Very true. Anyway, does anyone have other? Yeah. Last article.
Let's do another one. What do we want to go with? Do we want to talk about, I don't know. Corey, you want to pick one?
I don't have one to pick. Does anyone know? I can pick one at random.
I'm going to pick an easy layup to close us out. Hackers backed by Russia and China are infecting Soho routers.
This is a good one. I like this one
because it's like another one of those water is wet news stories.
Soho routers, what are we, in New York City or London? I don't care.
Soho. By the way, does anybody know what Soho stands for? Not the people on the show.
Small office, home office, right?
And Soho, what does it mean, like, if you're in London or in New York City?
I can't afford home office. I can't afford small office.
I can't afford anything. Are you walking here? So this is something that nation states, like if you're looking at a lot of like nation state cyber adversaries, offensive groups, things like that. And now I got the Rancid song in my head. IT career questions. You suck. Ruby, 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 Soho. Thank you. Thank you. You ruined it. God, that's going to be in my head all day. But if you look at like the Vault breaches and you look at the Shadow Brokers breach, there was a lot of exploits for Soho routers. And the reason why is Soho routers are many times the point of entry for attackers to gain access as initial access to gain a foothold into organizations. And then when you couple that with the fact that a lot of Soho routers are very, very consistently distributed in a place like Washington, D.C. or Moscow, there'll be one ISP that is providing the Soho routers for all of the different internet like access for all the citizens in that area. It becomes a very, very juicy target where you can develop an exploit for that device. And now you have highly targeted access into a population that is probably going to have some intel that you need. This is also an area that as pen testers, we don't pen test. Like I can count on my hand maybe like four times in the entire career of Black Hills Information Security where people were like, hey, we want you to look at our like consumer-based router to see if there's any vulnerabilities that can be exploited in this particular device. So yeah, nation states love these exploits. And I don't know, I really recommend that if you're using something like a Soho router, you should also use a Kinect Secure VPN device because they're clearly more, no, I'm joking.
Nation states love these vulnerabilities. Click now to see the top 10. These
vulnerabilities. But the biggest thing that sucks about these vulnerabilities is even though they have a critical mass in a geographic location, the critical mass tends to be small enough that it doesn't blow up into wide news whenever vulnerabilities are discovered for them as well.
Well, okay, John, you made that sound really sexy. Don't get me wrong.
What's that? I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you.
You made that whole thing sound really sexy. You were like, oh, CVEs and exploits and things. But wasn't this just default creds?
A lot of times it is. A lot of times it's, but sometimes it's even worse than default creds. Sometimes it's like a forced browsing vulnerability that gets you to an administration panel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of the vulnerabilities that you see in these devices are incredibly, incredibly basic vulnerabilities.
And they're afterthoughts. The devices themselves are afterthoughts. Like, let's say your company's setting up a branch office in Washington, D.C., like John said. You probably, yeah. You're just like, I don't know, go to Best Buy. You're not like, what, you know.
What's the Soho router that you'd recommend then? Like, honestly, I have cheap, like, ASUS stuff, right? And
I recommend pfSense recompiled to run on BSD. Well,
hold up. Okay, if you want to know the real recommendation, it's anything that auto-updates on its own.
Yes.
That is the recommendation. Mm. I don't care whether it's a WireGuard or whatever they're called, the ones that John had, I forget what they were called, but or Ubiquiti or whatever it is. Arguably, these were Ubiquiti, but for a while, I believe now, you still have to configure Ubiquiti to auto-update itself. Yep. And everyone should go do that if you have a Ubiquiti device.
And that but is whatever a public you have, service reminder, even without a Ubiquiti or auto-updating device, like update the firmware on your routers because it's you're going to go in and you're going to see that. It's like, oh, there's been a firmware update that is Alex, 2 years old when I haven't updated it in 3 years.
Alex, how do you tell that to your grandmother?
I know. Yeah.
Or you, grandfather
you
or whatever.
You don't. That's why you only purchase devices that auto update themselves anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
But a lot of times you don't have that option. And a lot of times it's provided by, like you can have your own device, but let's say that you have your own device. It's secure. It's amazing. You wrote it in Rust, whatever. you have this amazing device and I just lost my camera. Whoa, there's a new camera, new angle.
I'm scared.
It's weird. Just roll with it. But you have this amazing security device. There we go. There's the new me, everybody.
John, you look great today.
You have this amazing device, and I'm going to switch back to...
Is that a new lip gloss?
What's popping?
Looks good.
I'm working at an opposite angle, or acute angle from Kelly.
Look down at us directly, please. I'm scared.
I completely effing forgot what I was talking about. What the hell was I saying?
You were talking about buying routers for your grandparents.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's say that you have a secure router. You do all the things that we talk about. Your edge device is still going to be provided by your ISP. And in many of those devices, you have settings that can absolutely be used to compromise the rest of the network, like DNS settings. Like, what are the actual DNS servers that this device is actually going to forward all DNS requests to? You can rewrite those. So you can literally use this as a means to gain access to internal systems. Even if it's not exploit and then pivot, you can use it to set those things up. So a lot of this stuff is out of our control, honestly. And I honestly do not know. I have no idea what the solution to this problem is.
Well, okay, here's another good solution. You can bring in the Avanti liquidators to just destroy your Soho router. Every couple months, you just destroy it and buy another one. Like, got to keep them guessing, right?
Dude, with the Avanti liquidators, we can just come in. Like, we don't have to wait for a security breach. We can just periodically come in as a good spring cleaning.
Yeah, totally. It's proactive. It's, you know, you just destroy all your networking equipment regularly, and then you don't have to worry.
Yes, I love it. I think that this is a great idea. It gets us out in the country.
Totally.
It involves exercise, and it's important to get exercise.
I just use ConnectWise to connect in, and then just
You want to use... No, yeah. Hold on. Did you get the ConnectWise repo off of GitHub? Because it's infected.
I totally did. I installed it on my grandma's computer so I could easily come in and then configure her router to auto-update.
Grandma, so how come you haven't updated your firmware?
Genuinely not a bad idea though for legitimately to have an RMM tool in your grandma's environment where you can update her stuff regularly.
I also installed a Russian keyboard.
Okay, but so what are we supposed to walk away from?
Okay, here's what you walk away with. Number one, update your networking equipment regularly. Just do it. Even if it's automatic, great. If it's not automatic, still do it. Number two, bring in someone to sledgehammer your existing network equipment and replace it on a regular basis.
Avanti liquidators.
Yeah, I was gonna add a point that it's like, for, you know, like John said, like, well, what do you do if you're like, you know, you're a grandparent and you don't know how to do these? Like, befriend a nerd. If you're a nerd out there, befriend somebody that needs your help.
We like pizza.
When we go, like, you feed me pizza, I'll update your router. And it's like, part of the solution.
That's the solution.
One of the guys I went to school with, he had a consulting company that he was like an IT guy. And he told me his best customers were elderly people. He would give them a stack of business cards, and then next thing you know, his phone is ringing off the hook because they just pass him around like, this guy fixed my computer, call him. And he had no ads, no anywhere. So it was all word of mouth. And I was amazed. He told me the money he was bringing in, and he's just like a single dude going over, patching people's computers, showing them how to print, and just making money.
I'm out. If it involves printers, I'm out.
No,
he's doing the Lord's work.
Corey, it's an add-on service for Avanti liquidators. Like, we can solve your VPN update issues. We can also solve all of your print problems as well.
Yes, we can liquidate your printer in addition to your security vulnerabilities.
Alex, it reminds me of Wedding Singer, where he gets paid for his piano lessons with the two meatballs in his hands.
I forgot about that scene.
That is a good one.
All right, close it down. That's a good place to end it.
Let's end it there, because that's great. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for attending the news. With that, we'll see you next week.